here. Trying
Listen,
to...
I want to congratulate Larry McCarthy this morning.
Isn't that terrific news?
Unbelievable. I honestly didn't think he would have much of a chance because the GAA is such a tough organization to, you know, to get into and advance in. And it's remarkable that a guy from New York can go back and be elected the head of Ireland's biggest sporting group.
Yeah, and, you know, just to think that an election could choose anybody from outside of Ireland, because indeed they have been known as a very close-tied and a tidy cocoon all
right.
themselves.
You know, with, one of the, you know, most political organizations imaginable in terms of the infighting and who gets to the top and all that. So for Larry to do it running from 3,000 miles away is really an extraordinary accomplishment.
Yeah. Neil, just on that point, the Gaelic Athletic Association of Ireland, is that like the Vatican of Irish sports? How much influence do they have, and how much resentment is there around the world, particularly in the United States, that they seem to be calling the shots?
Yeah, no, I mean, the GAA is one of the greatest Irish organizations of all time. It's far more than people like might think of Major League Baseball, which only deals with baseball, but the GAA is rooted in every county, in every town, in every village in Ireland. There's at least one GAA team, and it's caught up in the whole pride of the town and the village when the team is playing. These are all amateur players who, you know, every summer, on every Sunday, you have these huge games, but alongside the huge games, you have the village games and the town and city games. And everybody's part of something when they're in the GAA. They're either part of the minor team, the junior team, the senior team, the county team. I mean, there's teams at every level and in college. So you're looking at one of the top two or three Irish organizations, period, in terms of membership, in terms of worldwide reach. They have teams in Australia. You know, obviously here in Gaelic Park, they have teams. They have teams in Chicago, Texas, everywhere. I mean, you couldn't throw a stone in any county in Ireland, or indeed in most countries across the world, and you'd probably hit a GAA team.
Yeah. What is the, you know, you were mentioning, and I would agree with you, it doesn't take much to have the infighting. What is their grievance with the Gaelic Players Association?
Well, this is going to be very interesting, Adrian, because the GPA is the organization put together by the players themselves, who are all amateurs and who insisted about 10 years ago that they get better consideration because they weren't getting things like medical expenses or travel expenses for what they were doing. So they started this organization, the Gaelic Players Association, which became very powerful and popular among the players. But one of the big problems, which Larry was very open about, was they used to come to New York, or they do come to New York, and they have a very big, successful dinner. But the feelings of the local GAA people here was that they weren't putting anything back into New York GAA, which comparative to the size of the GPA would be a very small organization, but one that keeps the flag flying for generations of Irish who come to America, and indeed Irish Americans. And so Larry was always quite upset by the fact that the GPA, which raised a lot of money from Irish people in New York, did not put any money back, or enough money back, into the local GAA organization. So I'd say there's one place where Larry's victory mightn't be as popular.
Yeah, well, it's definitely, it's a sore point and a legitimate one. Some of the other, you know, disagreements are kind of parochial and
you know, I think, if you know, you see once a year, like, a team from Connacht, Mayo, or Leitrim, or whatever, come over and they go to Gaelic Park, and it's just a fantastic atmosphere. And it's really worth trying to keep the GAA going in America, even despite the fact there's so little immigration, unfortunately. But, you know, without that big game every year, it's a whole sort of centerpiece for many, many people, many Irish people living in New York. And I'm sure Larry will be working very hard on that. But, you know, it's just an extraordinary success for Larry. My hat goes off to him.
Yeah. And the GAA, it covers Gaelic football, it covers hurling. It encompasses, that is the...
And Adrian, the biggest growth area in the last few years has been ladies football and hurling.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, you go to the ladies football final in Croke Park now, there's 50,000 people in it.
My God.
And, you know, I know in your day, the idea of a woman going out in a Gaelic pitch, you know, especially in Mayo, where there's...
Yeah.
You know, to have such strange customs down there, to probably take her off the field.
If I were you, I wouldn't go there. At least I can identify with the county. You know, you have a traveller's background. You're born in Tipperary. You wound up in, you know, in Drogheda.
You're very unfair.
Yeah.
You know.
Actually, the truth is
that I came out here. The first summer I came out was playing with a Gaelic football team. So
really? I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, in Chicago. So, I mean, it's actually more than a game. It's how young people like me got connected in America and got to know people.
Yeah.
So it's an outstanding group, and I'm so glad Larry's going to get his opportunity.
Yeah.
I see, though, he doesn't start until next year, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, that really is strange. But anyway... that's it. And he has to bag and baggage go back for the 3-year stint. So, let me, Neil, your newest book, A New Ireland, you know, how Europe's
right.
most conservative country became the most liberal. That in itself... is something I wonder if particularly across North America, with the exception of those who've traveled to Ireland, if there is the realization which you have so aptly encompassed in your new book, that Ireland has changed. When we think of Ireland changing, and most, say, tourists who go to Ireland, changing because of the infrastructure in Ireland, the ease of travel, of that. But something major has taken place. So maybe you start with this. What does your book, where does it, I know it's up to the minute, but where do you start with the story of how Ireland changed?
Well, Adrian, I think, first of all, an awful lot of Americans ask me that very same question, what the hell has happened in Ireland and what is going on in Ireland? Because, you know, you had the legalization of same-sex marriage, you had the legalization of abortion, you had huge problems for the survival of the Catholic Church. So you had, like, a fundamental... change in the whole structure of the country. And this is something that has happened very, very quickly. But it began, as you well know, I think, with the church abuse cases, when the Catholic Church, which had been such a powerful group for hundreds of years, thousands of years in Ireland, back to St. Patrick's time, suddenly came apart very dramatically. Back in the 1970s and 80s, there was all these rumours about what was going to happen. But it really became, like in the rest of the world, a massive scandal. And during that scandal, the church lost an awful lot of its power and its authority. So a lot of organizations that had been completely committed to the church and all that just literally gave up on them. And so that was a huge shock to people in Ireland, because growing up in Ireland, you know, whatever the church said was law, basically, whether it was on the legal books or not. But I think what's happened since that happened is there's a whole liberalization going on where people are saying the church is not there to stop us doing things anymore. Of course, the issue of gay marriage was one that was very prominent in Europe at the time. And, you know, people in Ireland decided to go for it, who had been liberalized and set free from the church teachings on that issue. And then, to everyone's total surprise, the ordinary Irish people went along with it.
Yeah.
And then the ordinary Irish people went along with abortion in certain circumstances. And then, you know, it just changed the whole structure of the country in terms of how people thought about it. But you're right, a lot of Americans are pretty confused about the dramatic change in Ireland from 20, 25 years ago even.
Yeah. Neil, in addition to, you know, when we talk about, and God knows, the association with clerical abuse, you would imagine in, you know, in some reports that it was confined to Ireland, but I think the shock of having the Island of Saints and Scholars, having all those abuses exposed, it was only heightened by the investigations with respect to, you know, the industrial schools, the nuns. Many of us really can't, you know, get our grip on that. And it's almost a sense of disbelief, and we become very defensive and say, well, that might have been some of them, but, you know, the ones we're familiar with did one hell of a job, and, you know, the odd rotten apple syndrome there. But truth of the matter is that, you know, the industrial schools, you know, the Magdalen laundries, the burden of what should have been the Irish government was thrown over, you know, and shoved on nuns and sisters who were basically, you know, had to go by the guidelines of the Irish government, and for that matter, to again had the interference of the church, of clerics.
Yeah, I think you can't separate the church and the state. I mean, both were equally responsible. I think what happened was De Valera was such a powerful figure in Ireland, and yet he was deeply and proudly very, very Catholic, and he allowed people like Archbishop McQuaid in Dublin to set very strong and rigid rules about all kinds of things that really had nothing to do with the church. And the church and state for a very long time were hand in hand in terms of, you know, pushing their agenda in Ireland. I mean, the 1948 Constitution in Ireland is a very Catholic doctrine. It's written, it opens by saying about the special position of the Catholic Church, which, you know, nowadays seems very strange, but that's how deeply they were sunk into the whole country in Ireland. But I think, my book opens with Father Flanagan of Boystown, and a remarkable, incredible man originally from Roscommon, going to Ireland in the 1940s, getting a huge welcome because he was famous because of the big movie. And he went around to those places, the reformatories, the industrial schools, and the Christian Brothers schools, and he told people, this is all wrong. You can't lock young kids up. You can't use physical violence against kids. And he basically got run out of the country, Adrian.
Oh, I know.
Even though he was a huge international star at the time. So that gives you an example of some of the things that were going on. And I think if you were to look at a moment, I would say the very first papal visit to Ireland by Karol Wojtyla when he was Pope, was really the moment when Ireland reached its height of affection and love for the church and for everything that they stood for. Because what Pope John Paul was a superstar in Ireland, and literally millions turned out to see him. And that was the highlight for the church. And then right after that, it starts to deteriorate. And one of the things that is a very vivid memory is when Pope John Paul was getting off the helicopter in Galway, the two priests there to meet him were two priests. One was Bishop Casey and the other was Father Michael Cleary. Both later accused of very, very horrible sex crimes against young kids. And it makes you think, you know, that they were the stars of the Catholic Church at the time and they were getting away with this thing. So obviously it all came tumbling down, and that's what my book tries to show, is that how gradually the whole In fact, the church just got too powerful. They'd have been a lot better off being challenged. Like, say, the Catholic Church here was never as radically influential as the one in Ireland was, because there were other religions here and other interests. But as you know, 93% of the people in Ireland were Catholic when we were growing up.
Yeah.
And nobody questioned the priest, nobody questioned anyone in authority. And if you did, you were looked on as a very strange person.
Yeah, in addition to which that, you know, when we think of an Ireland that banned the sale of prophylactics of condoms, that might be just a telltale right there, in the sense that, you know, who's running
the show
here?
There's no room at all given to people, you know, to modernize.
And whatever came out of Rome was taken literally by Ireland, and if indeed they could make it any tougher, they seemed to interpret that, the hierarchy.
Yeah, and we turned a blind eye to the fact that 10,000 Irish women every year were going to England for abortions.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we look back on it now, it all seems so terrible. But at the time, nobody was able to question it, or say if you tried to question it, you know, you were like Father Flanagan, you were thrown out of the country.
And Neil, in the period, you know, going again for the last, few decades, what was the redeeming value of that period where I grew up, in an era where, we didn't notice the grip that the church had there. There was no separation of church and state. The state seemed to be go along with it. But what came out of that? There are, you know, how often do we hear people saying, the Christian Brothers, they were brutal, but you know, at least we got a good education from it, and you know.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think I was a Christian Brothers boy. I remember one particular Christian brother who inspired my love of writing and helped me an awful lot to become a journalist. You know, so I mean, they wasn't all bad, these institutions, but I think what really, when I look back at it now, Adrian, like you, I unfortunately I was never abused or anything like that, and I wasn't even aware of it. It was nothing that ever came across other than this was the way everybody else was.
Yeah.
So you didn't think twice about it. It's only when you got older, when the country opened up a bit and people started coming in and saying, what the hell is going on here? You know, you're run by the church, not by the state or whatever, that people began to ask the questions. And then, of course, the collapse of the church was very dramatic when it happened. But it just seemed that absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that happened with the church. And it had its impact. I mean, I think Irish people, the most painful issue that I deal with in the book is that young Indian woman in Galway University who was having a baby, and they told her they'd lost the baby, but they couldn't remove the dead fetus because of Catholic doctrine. She was a Hindu from India, and she died a horrible death because of that rule. And then a lot of people just said, this is insane. The Catholic Church is telling an Indian woman whose baby's already dead and non-viable that she can't have an abortion. I think incidents like that really turn people against the status quo and brought about a huge and dramatic change.
What, how was the immigrant story, those growing up in Ireland who realized, I know in my time we didn't realize that we were growing for export, but what about younger people, who were growing up, who had just got a distaste for not just their religious or their clerical leaders, but also with the government, saying, "You want to know something? No, this isn't right, and to hell with them all." Their lack of interest, for instance, in Northern Ireland, many as we know, would come here, and if you wanted to talk about Northern Ireland and the struggle for equality and peace and justice. They didn't know, and secondly, they didn't want to engage in that.
No, it was a very, very, I mean, De Valera and Dr. McQuaid were the two most powerful men in Ireland. And I'll give you an example from the book, Adrian, of something that shows you more than anything what was on McQuaid's mind. He called together a meeting of the bishops, every bishop in Ireland, in 1956. And he called them together this was a time when millions were leaving the country, 500,000 people a year left the country because there's no jobs. And the emergency meeting was about the fact that Tampax were about to go on sale in Ireland. And this had to be stopped at all costs because women might get stimulated by Tampax.
Yeah.
I mean, you think I'm joking, that's actually true.
Yeah.
And that's what the bishops were worried about.
Yeah.
Think about that and you think, well, Jesus, yeah.
Yeah. Neil, there are a great number of people who might embellish their own stories with how they helped bring about the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. You were in the thick of that at a time when that was nothing to brag about, you know?
No, but I mean, you know, Adrian, you and I know that, say, on the issue of immigration, you have to start somewhere. We did on that issue, and we did on the North. And we were very fortunate that at the right time, the right people appeared, talking particularly about President Clinton, who was so central to the peace process. And really, it was Irish-American groups, starting with the Irish-American presidential meeting that they had with Irish candidates that was so important in terms of getting a president on the record saying that he would try and help with the issue of Northern Ireland. And that was so huge when you think of it. Historically, for over 200 years, the United States had never done anything to favor the Irish over the English in real terms because of the special relationship. So, you know, seeing a guy like Clinton suddenly take it on just inspired a whole group of people then to get involved and to make it happen. And, fortunately, we're now looking at peace in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Next week or the week after, you'll have the Sinn Féin and DUP leader, two women, coming to Washington together. The government is back together there. Sinn Féin have just, gone way up in terms of people's voting power and supporting them. And, you know, you're now looking at a very different situation than you were, say, 20 years ago when the Troubles were still smouldering away and people were still getting killed. I mean, nothing's perfect, but I think Irish America can take great credit for the role they played, particularly in getting the president and George Mitchell involved.
How would, is there somewhat of a parallel here, though? The result of this election is that a great number of people were just fed up with the status quo. Every election turned out to be more of the same. How much of that, how much of the electorate would you feel are just saying, tell with it? I mean, let's not...
There was an amazing article in the Irish Times by Kitty Holland, whose mother you might remember, Mary Holland, the writer.
Yes.
And Kitty went around this working class area in Dublin called Clondalkin, and which had gone 90% for Sinn Féin very dramatically because in previous elections it had been Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, whatever. And she knocked on the doors and these people would talk to her, and what they would say is, my 35-year-old son is living with me, so is his wife and his kid. They're not able to afford a house. They're not even able to afford renting a house. And house after house, she came across these stories of people who were never really going to get started in life because they could never get a mortgage people who were left behind that the government were not talking about, people who desperately needed a helping hand and a reassurance. And while Leo Varadkar and Coveney and all that were doing this great work, and they did do great work on Brexit, there was a very deep sense in this part of the electorate that, you know, the issue of housing, the issue of healthcare, the issue of homelessness were not really being taken seriously.
And also you're talking about another generation, the youth, those who did not experience any of the fallout from the troubles in Northern Ireland. It became like that and most wars in history, and the fact that a war throughout the world was taken for granted. So what? So that had very little to do with us. Was it that they choose not to be influenced by what is relatively recent history, or they didn't care?
I think, Adrian, excuse me, when I was home around Christmas time, the one thing that struck me talking to nephews and nieces was the war in the north was like the Second World War to me growing up. It was something that happened years ago. I heard about it and I read about it, but it was never a part of my life. And
it was over.
Saying, oh yeah, vaguely I remember something about that. But, you know, these are people who were born in 1998, 1999, and they have no particular memory of it. I think from that point of view, it's very good in a way, because everyone's getting a new start. And Sinn Féin are certainly developing the kind of people politically who they developed in the north. I mean, if you remember, when they finally went into politics, they had some really great young political leaders who made a huge name for themselves. And that wasn't happening in the south until this election. And you see guys like Pierre Starty, Owen O'Brien.
Yes.
There's a couple of very smart young women who would be big names in Irish politics. Yeah. It took them a while to basically train these people in into how to do politics the right way. But right now, you know, it will suit them to be in opposition for another couple of years to, you know, perfect their front bench and get their politics in line and order. But, you know, we just saw an election that was historic, where Ireland will never be just two parties anymore. There probably will be three, or if there is two, it'll be Sinn Féin against a combination of Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil.
Isn't there, though, the feeling that the electorate, the Irish electorate, are going to have to either vote for more of the same, since the two parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, at best it looks like they're just switching leadership, and they can't even agree on that.
I know.
Kevin O'Connor, who brought us the news there, talking about, you know, the possibility of another election has now kind of moved into the category of a probability. What the hell is that going to do? Will it, unless they hand it, you know, unless the current government kind of hands it to Sinn Féin and say, listen, we have pledged all of our forever that we'd have nothing to do with you. So, you know, all right, go ahead and see what you can do with it and see what happens in a new election.
Yeah, I think if there's a new election, I think you and I would agree that Sinn Féin would be the big winners of that. I can't see Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, honestly. There's no good choices for them, but I think the worst choice for them would be a new election, because if Fianna Fáil did badly in the last one, only getting 38 seats after they were expecting 50 or 55, they're going to do worse this time, because Martin's attacks on Sinn Féin have been particularly vicious for some unknown reason, because, you know, a Fianna Fáil Sinn Féin government was actually the one that should have been under consideration. Fine Gael have been in power for 9 years. People were tired of them. And the obvious combination was the two opposition parties. But Micheál Martin did not want that, in which case he's left with only Fine Gael to go into government with. And if the two of them do coalesce, at least one of those parties is going to be hurt permanently by it. Mm. And my suspicion would be it's Fianna Fáil, because we remember they were almost wiped out after the economic collapse in 2011.
Neil, on your book, A New Ireland, How Europe's Most Conservative Country Became Its Most Liberal, it will be launched on, I believe, the 10th of March.
That's right.
But it is available through Amazon, is it?
Yeah, pre-sale on Amazon, Kindle, and it's a hardcover book. So if you want to go on Amazon.com and just type in the name of New Ireland, it comes up.
Yeah. I want to ask you, though, as you, again, you're primarily covering recent decades of change.
Yes.
Would, here's a question, we could make it rhetorical, or how, is there a chance that it could be reversed, that we could go back? Is this something that you shall never return? It's just not.
I think the days of the power of the church in Ireland are over forever. I think the Catholic Church collapse will be probably, along with the Troubles, the biggest story of the last 50 years in terms of how Ireland looked, say, in 1980 compared to how it looks now. In the aftermath of the Pope's visit, the first Pope, John Paul, there was a huge sense that Ireland would go back to its faith, but the exact opposite thing happened.
Right.
So I don't think that's ever going to change, Adrian. I think the politics of Ireland is going to change dramatically. I think you've had for 100 years civil war politics, ultimately, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, essentially taking turns to be in power, though Fianna Fáil were in for longer. But that's all changed now, and that will be the biggest dramatic political change.
Yeah, they even sold, some would say they sold out, and they were bitter, enemies, and you wore your badge, on your allegiance to either party on your sleeve, and when things got rough, they actually, they had to back down and say, okay, let's get together here. And now there is a situation where they either tolerate or at least make nice with, with the Sinn Féin party, or they're out.
They're out, yeah. I mean, Sinn Féin remind me a little bit of Bernie Sanders in that, the enthusiasm of the young, like older people cannot figure out what the hell Bernie looks like to me, like an old lefty that I knew for years, who shouting about Russia and Nicaragua and Cuba and all this nonsense.
Yeah, the young people are different. They're a bit cheeky there to be talking about old lefties, those in glass houses. Go ahead.
But I mean, the young people want something different, and particularly in terms of economic times in Ireland, and like here, people feel the country went well ahead, but a lot of people got left behind. And if you're looking at the last 2 weeks, Sinn Féin have been holding these mass meetings with thousands of people coming to them, saying, basically we're the forgotten people, what's been done for us, healthcare is terrible, there's all this gentrification going on. There's one statistic that scares me, Adrian, is that Dublin will have 500,000 more people in the next 20 years. Now, where are they going to put them? They don't build up. They don't build apartment complexes. You know yourself that it's already sprawling. I mean, people living in Carlow and places like that,
absolutely,
commuting to Dublin. So I don't know where they actually, how they actually ever manage this housing crisis.
Yeah.
But it's certainly problems that any government, no matter if it's Sinn Féin or whoever, will face in the next 5-10 years. That'll be very, very tough.
Yeah, but also the starting point might be to fix the totally out of control, housing crisis, the homeless crisis, and in particular the healthcare, which has gone to pot altogether. I mean,
yeah, I mean, the healthcare, my nephew's wife is a doctor, an emergency room doctor, and she told me on Christmas Eve there was 85 patients and two doctors in her emergency ward. And, you know, she said the problem is that here again, 50% of Irish doctors who graduate, young doctors who graduate, go abroad because they know the workload and they know the pay isn't very good in Ireland.
Yeah.
So you're already, the Irish taxpayer is paying for 50% of doctors to leave the country.
Yeah.
So it's very discouraging from the Irish point of view. There seems to be some issue there. Like, we talked to Mike Dowling, the head of Northwell Health,
who's
such a fantastic medical innovative person, and he's been over there advising them, and he just says it's so bureaucratic you just wouldn't believe it.
Holding on to their power.
But
it's going to be, you know, it is a new Ireland, and your book is fantastic. It's been
Well, thank you, Adrian.
Great.